Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. There's so much going on today, these days, in our world today, that it's often easy to kind of forget about history or write off history. And I've always been naturally drawn towards historical forces, what came before, music, art, architecture, ideas, philosophy. So it's taken me a while to realize that not everybody is like that. And when I'm kind of called to the mat to justify my continued fascination in history, particularly at a time when everything is sort of going off the rails, when the way things have been are no indication of how they're going to be. There's such a sense of possibility and unpredictable threat that the sort of lessons that are traditionally thought to be drawn from history seem maybe not so so important, and that just figuring out how to maneuver through the today becomes the philosophy. And that's not the way I see it. And I came up with this analogy the other day, and I'm not sure whether it entirely works, but I think it does work. It's like there's a sunset, right? And you're looking east, away from the sunset, far into the distance, and you see these tiny little houses. And those houses are like things that have gone on before. Ways people lived lives, the technologies they used, the ideas they thought, and it's pretty vague. It's hard to see. You need to. That sun is setting. Once in a while, the reflection hits some window. And even though it's far, far away, 10, 15, 20 miles away, the way that history doesn't just tell us about what happened, but the way that mirrors and reflects our own moment, and particularly our own moment as we plunge into the ancient histories. How did they think about the future? And that reminds us that the way we think, closer seats, as it were, is often just as bound up with local ideas, with foolish social concepts, with our own myopic obsession with certain things in our society that are very hot and very attractive of energy, when perhaps far more significant things are going on right beneath us that we can't really see. And peering back at other people's futures is one of the great ways of reflecting where we are now, this kind of fragmentary glint of another way of seeing and being. And this sort of thought came to mind as I was reading the book from this week's guest. The book is called We Are Amphibians, Julian and Aldous Huxley on the Future of Our Species. And it's by R.S. Deese, though I'm going to call him Sam, who teaches at Boston University. And this is a wonderful book and very insightful on all sorts of matters of ecology, transhumanism, the future of religion. And it really tells a remarkable story. I've been fascinated with Aldous Huxley. I think, like a lot of people, they know about Aldous Huxley more than his brother Julian, though I had come across his work as well. He features sometimes in paranoid Christian conspiracy theories about the one world government, so that's one way you might have met Julian's work. But of course, Aldous has had an enormous influence and I think I'm back now. Sorry about that, kids. So yes, Aldous Huxley has had an enormous influence on our culture, but we tend to think about him only in terms of a few books, Brave New World, maybe Island, and of course the great Doors of Perception. But his whole perspective is much more interesting than you would get just from his role as a kind of hippie forebear. And both he and his brother, as we'll find out, were very keen on understanding the future and how it was going to be shaped. But before we bring on Sam to the show, let's bring our co-host on to Expanding Mind. Hey, Maja, how you doing?
Hey, Eric, I'm really good. You know, it's so amazing, the story that you just told about the sunset and facing the direction and perspective, because I just last night and this morning had a huge synchronicity trail involving the story of Jacob and Israel in the Bible. And what one of the things I found out was, you know, in the story, basically, Jacob finds out that his brother is going to, like, come and attack him and, like, kill him, right? So he starts freaking out, and he's fretting, and he's got all this anxiety, like, what's going to happen in the future? So he, like, makes all these plans and preparations to prepare for an attack from his brother. And then he's, like, alone at night, and he's, like, riddled with this anxiety, like, oh, my God, we're all going to die. But really, it turns out that he had messed up his brother and was feeling guilty. So it's like he thought his brother was going to attack him, because of course his brother would attack him, because he was like a bad person or deserved it or did this bad thing to his brother. So the whole story basically says that Jacob popped out of his misery once he figured out that everyone was going to die, and he started being afraid for his family and, like, the other people, and he stopped thinking about himself for a second. And there's a lesson in that whole story is, like, in order to gain any perspective or see, like, how the future is going to be or take charge on how you can form a future is to kind of come out of the fear of your own, like, death and misery and just kind of, like, see it clearly and try to make some progress instead of, like, sitting around fretting all the time. So that was very much like kind of what you're talking about with being able to shift your perspective from just our own, you know, daily issues to try to look at some kind of larger scope.
Excellent little a parable there for us. So with that, we'll bring on Sam D. Sam, thanks for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the introduction. I love the story about the sunset as well. It's a very nice spatial metaphor for how we think about time. And when I find something in history that that speaks to me, it's like that little sudden reflection of some distant facet that you described just now. So anyways, it's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Well, you know, there's so many places to start on this with this book, and since you have two characters, maybe the easiest place to start is to talk about their family and where they came from, in particular their famous grandfather, and how you know, there's a reason that there was so much interaction and similarity between the two brothers, even though they went down very different paths. I mean, the Huxley family was really one of those capital F families where, you know, ideas and a sort of social and intellectual heritage comes through the DNA almost. So maybe that's a good place to start.
I would like to start with that, and I thanks for bringing up T.H. Huxley at the very beginning of this, because I think I'm like a lot of people who grew up in, you know, post-World War II United States. I went to school in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and the first Huxley I ever heard of was Aldous Huxley, and the first thing I read by him was Brave New World, as a, you know, 14-year-old, and then a few years later, Doors of Perception, and they both just blew me away, and then other Aldous things would come my way, like Ape and Essence, some of his post-war writings about democracy, science, and peace. And I knew something about T.H. Huxley because my father was of, you know, he'd been born in the 1920s, and he knew about agnosticism and T.H. Huxley coining the term. So I knew there was this guy back there who was a big deal. But at some point in my late 20s, I read Evolution and Ethics by T.H. Huxley, And it's as mind-blowing, at least to me, as any of the sort of top-drawer Aldous Huxley stuff. It's his attempt to find some kind of religious bearing in the world based on a completely agnostic perspective and on a perspective that saw no prescriptive... no prescriptive message from evolution through natural selection. And, you know, he was Darwin's bulldog and had you know, argued for the validity of Darwin's theory of evolution through natural selection. But unlike others at the time, he felt that there was no moral lesson to be drawn from the story of our evolution through natural selection. Whatever moral point of view we had, it came from within us, and he could never explain, you know, how that might be. So although he was, I guess you might say, a secular thinker, there's a profound mystery at the heart of T.H. Huxley's worldview, and that mystery surrounds human consciousness, and it surrounds where we get our sense of what we should be, what we could be, and where we might be going. And so... He was enormously influential on both of his grandsons, surviving grandsons, Julian and Aldous, felt that they, you know, had something of a burden to carry in terms of that name or something of a standard to bear. It affected Julian Huxley to the extent that one of his contemporaries said he was so busy being a Huxley he couldn't be himself, whereas in the case of Aldous Huxley, perhaps as the youngest sibling, perhaps as a very gifted satirist, and perhaps as somebody with a sort of mystical bent, really from very early in his life, it was more of a starting point, the legacy of T.H. Huxley. It wasn't something that he felt that he had to, maintain, I think. Anyway,
it seems like for one way of seeing all three of the figures is this attempt to build a meaningful story or image or a kind of religious aspiration, but outside of the language of religion, and that really, you know, is an incredibly important project through the 20th century, but it's one that has gotten very peculiar these days when it seems so much that, like, science and technology are just supposed to kind of solve it all, and these larger kind of moral issues almost sound sort of fuddy-duddy, even as all sorts of conflicts and the kinds of things that these fellows were looking forward are now part of our everyday life. So it's a very strange moment where we look back and we can see a kind of a perception of, like, how, for example, Darwinian evolution would undermine certain ways that society was organized, and that there would be a need for stories and practices and ways of organizing collective meanings in order to deal with the kind of chaos that comes from that.
Yeah, that's you described exactly the project that, you know, makes the Huxleys interesting to me. That is, I might, you know, just using my own vocabulary, I might say it in a slightly different style, but I think we're talking about the same thing, and that's the idea of constructing some way of inspiring oneself and maybe a way of helping human beings to be inspired together that is non-dogmatic, that takes in the information that we get from science without being a form of scientism that says, you know, here's the path forward, we know exactly what it is. And, you know, if I were going to try to answer, you know, in a quick way how each of them did that, T.H. Huxley's was sort of a stoic, you know, very masculine, late Victorian thing about, like, look, there's no obvious meaning to the universe. Just deal with it. Be stoic and live the right way because you should. And don't look for any validation either from ancient scripture or from the natural world, because he posed human morality and the forces of the natural world as actually diametrically opposed. So, you know, that was his answer to it. We're moral by resisting everything that we've inherited from nature, which would, you know, cause us to seek to dominate others, et cetera, et cetera. And that's quite Victorian, even though it's also quite, you know, it's quite secular. With Julian and Aldous each trying to fashion, you know, a worldview that is as powerful as religion but isn't dogmatically religious, you know, with Julian, I think it really becomes all about progress. And so this is very 20th century, and you know, somewhat, you know, it echoes some of the late 19th century thinking too. But whereas T.H. Huxley and actually Charles Darwin himself, you know, were both careful to say, look, evolution describes a kind of change. We're not really prepared to say that it's progress. You know, organisms evolve to adapt to the conditions that they're in. Julian really said, no, you know, progress is inscribed in the structure of the universe. Simple elements, you know, became more complex elements, and more complex elements became self-replicating molecules, you know, which became organisms, and then organisms became more complex, and very much sort of deist chain of being up to, you know, human beings, or as Julian Huxley would say, man, you know, as the most advanced and most complex, and then something beyond that. And it was therefore Julian who coined the term transhumanism in the early 1950s to try to imagine human beings consciously directing their own evolution, since it wouldn't happen through natural selection anymore. And some of that, you know, he had experimented with ideas of technological enhancement of human beings. He was into eugenics. And, you know, this is what gives him kind of a sinister cast in a lot of people's minds, even though in the 1930s he was a very passionate anti-fascist and anti-Nazi activist. But that idea of progress with a capital P, and Aldous was, I think, always suspicious of that. There's a bit of kind of romantic element to his thinking a little bit. I wouldn't call him a counter-Enlightenment figure, but certainly a great deal of skepticism towards Enlightenment notions of progress. And even before, you know, he experimented with mescaline, you know, in other psychedelic substances in 1953 and beyond, you know, that mystical bent was extremely strong. And so his vision is really not so much a vision forward as a sort of transcendence, a vision out, you know, out of the conundrum of being human, sort of stretching out beyond it, both maybe into more, you know, ethereal realms of consciousness, but also, you know, even not resisting more kind of animal forms of consciousness that people would think of as kind of beneath the level of the human. It didn't mean that, you know, it didn't mean that Aldous didn't believe that society couldn't get better. But his definition of progress was progress in terms of compassion. You would measure the progress of a society by whether it becomes, you know, a little bit more compassionate. And it's not so
right.
much
and,
about
and that, and,
its technical
and
achievement.
And that had a social form. I think that had a social form too, if I'm not mistaken, in the sense of he had a greater emphasis on localism, on decentralized government, on
you
know, even a kind of communal sort of thinking. So there was a sort of social form to his view that you could still sort of see as being part of an evolved aspect of human life. You know, it's funny because in a lot of ways, they represent, you know, the two sides of what you could think of as transhumanism. You know, if you transhumanism as a sort of technologically, scientifically driven notion of progress, of control, of a kind of technocratic
but individualized technocratic view, you know, also collective. And on the other hand, a more human potential notion that the transhuman potentials come from within and come from practices that, you know, maybe have been around for thousands of years in some cases. And it's really kind of odd that these two brothers really captured, you know, one of the main dynamics as that people face when they sit here and go, wow, human beings are not finished. They have no place in some defined natural order because they make themselves, because they extrude culture, because they transform through technology and economies. So where is this going? How do we direct this? How do we, you know, understand ourselves? And those are really some of the more dominant models that don't just, you know, refuse it all and say we need to go back and reject technology and reject the future. If you say, no, I'm going to embrace the future, you know, there's not that many options. You know, you're either really, you're behind the technology or you're like kind of suspicious of the technology and desperately calling for a kind of social and even a psychological consciousness expansion.
Well, yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head exactly about how these guys are like two sides of the same coin. And I was talking to a colleague today about transhumanism because, you know, I see stuff about transhumanism all the time. I mean, I just, like, you know, I get Google alerts. So how's the word being used? And most of the time, you know, it's being used to describe stuff that I'm not really that interested in, you know, like radical life extension or prosthetic, you know, parts or exoskeletons that'll make, you know, people into Superman or something like that. I'm just not, you know, I'm not mad at that stuff or anything, but I'm not, it just doesn't really interest me. And that there's that other idea of, look, to be human itself is very contingent. It's not a frozen thing. And it seems that, you know, human beings are always reaching beyond what they are. And, you know, by that logic, if you, you know, framed it in terms of, you know, myths about human origins, you could say that Eve was the first transhumanist. It's, you know, she wanted to reach beyond the parameters that were set for human beings in a given time and place, reach for knowledge, you know, and it, that type of transhumanism, which is, you know, not necessarily something that involves a lot of gear. I do think that's the way Aldous Huxley thought. I couldn't ever see combing through all of his writings, and I could have missed it, but I never saw him use the term. And that is, he didn't adopt the term, you know, when Julian coined it. And for Julian, it might have been, you know, a bit of an experiment. He was always sort of trying to promote things. You know, when you know, fascism was on the rise, and he would say, well, you know, we in Britain need to have a unifying ideology to, you know, prepare us to deal with the fascists. And then when the Cold War was in full swing in the 50s, you know, same thing. Well, the world's fallen into two blocks, and the Eastern Bloc has this ideology of Marxist-Leninism, and golly, we need an ideology too. And so sometimes he'd call it evolutionary humanism, sometimes he'd call it, you know, transhumanism. And I don't see, you know, he used it in a couple of lectures in the early 50s, and then he wrote the essay Transhumanism, which he published in New Bottles for New Wine in 1957. But when you read that essay, you know, even though Julian Huxley had been, you know, for like sperm banks for geniuses like himself, and for, you know, in the 30s he talked about it might be a good idea to grow babies in bottles because they could have bigger brains, and he wrote that a couple of years before Aldous came out with Brave New World. By the 50s, and he's using the term transhumanism, he's kind of talking about reaching beyond ourselves in a in more of a psychological or spiritual way. I don't know that he'd abandon, you know, those technological ideas, but he he seemed to be thinking about it more of a he takes that Renaissance saying nothing human is alien to me, and he said let's expand that beyond the human so that nothing is alien to us. And that
well,
seems
let me
to
ask
be,
you something, because yeah, that, that's interesting. Yeah, do you know if he was studying, like, Nietzsche? Did that have, like, influence on that kind of shift? And, I mean, also...
Oh, I love that. Yeah, that's a great question.
Like, because it seems like he went after the Nazis were so, like, getting into that, instead of him kind of saying, like, this is why what I'm advocating is different, he seemed to switch in another course.
I think, you know, if you read some of the first things he wrote... He wrote a book called The Individual and the Animal Kingdom. It's the first thing he published, and you know, oddly, he was a professor at Rice, you know, what's now Rice University in Houston. They'd picked him. They were going to build this world class university because they had a bunch of money, and they hired Huxley. You know, they hired Julian Huxley, and he published his first book about that time, and it was Individual and Animal Kingdom, and it begins with a quote from Nietzsche. And, you know, this is like 1913, so it precedes the catastrophes of the First World War and the Second World War and fascism and all this stuff. And he also quotes, to a much greater extent, Bergson. And I think he was very influenced by the sort of creative evolution idea of Henri Bergson and it's actually a nice point of commonality between Julian and Aldous because, you know, when Aldous tried to explain the psychedelic experience and sort of guess what was probably happening, he relied on a Bergsonian model of the brain as something that's sort of filtering out data that's not going to help you survive necessarily. So you know, your brain's like, you know, filter it out, but you know, something might be really pretty, but you don't have time to notice it. So they had a commonality in that interest in Bergson. And I think, you know, as a scientist, Julian maybe, you know, distanced himself from some of that stuff later on, maybe because, you know, he didn't want to seem flaky. I don't think Aldous ever, you know, he had a great interest in people like Havelock Ellis and Bergson, you know, well into his, you know, to the end of his life, really. So,
you know, there's an interesting thing about the term transhuman that, you know, towards the end of his life, Aldous started speaking about human potentialities. And as write about in your book, this really feeds directly into Esalen and the human potential movement. And one of the sort of side, you know, or, you know, fellow travelers of the human potential movement was transpersonal psychology. And transpersonal psychology started by people like Groff and you know, coming out of notions of like Maslow's notion of peak experience and those kinds of things. It kind of paralleled that human potential movement. And when they were trying to figure out what to call it, I think that if I remember it right, Maslow actually wanted to call it transhuman psychology.
I would not be surprised.
Groff was like,
no,
call it transpersonal. It's better.
Yeah. It's a minefield how these terms, you know, when I was doing this book, I started scouring texts to see where I could find people using the term transhumanism, and it was in one of Maslow's books, and he cited, you know, he had a tremendous admiration for Aldous Huxley, and he cited him as a person who'd reached a level of transcendence, you know, and so that would be adequately described, you know, as transhuman. But like I said, I didn't see it in Aldous, and it's more or less, I think it kind of morphed, you know, there was a guy named D.S. Halsey, who was sort of a science writer, and he wrote about the possibility of cyborgs in the 1960s, and some of the guys who Julian Huxley had known, like the biologist J.B.S. Haldane and another scientist named J.D. Bernal. These guys were kind of hardcore Marxists and sort of like technology should dominate nature. And they speculated about things like, you know, having gestating babies in bottles or ectogenesis. That's how I pronounce it. I'm not sure if I'm right pronouncing it that way, but ectogenesis. Bernal speculated about human-machine hybrids, that this would be a way to explore space. You know, you'd have to, like, attach a human brain to some machinery that could stand withstand being in space, you know, for months or years. And that, you know, that sort of cyborg, you know, let's just get out the wrenches and screwdrivers and make people super, you know, that's it's more or less come to mean that in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. FM 2030, you know, wrote this book, Are You Transhuman? I think in 89, and that's a, more or less, I think, what it's come to mean, which is, I think by the time Julian Huxley was using it, he really was thinking a lot less about technology than he had been in the early 30s. And maybe, you know, maybe in fact, you know, in reaction to some of the horrific, you know, revelations about, you know, trying to create a Ubermensch, you know, in the Third Reich and all of that sort of stuff.
Well, I think probably the place to shift the conversation to then is away from this the technology and towards ecology, where both of these guys have played an, you know, enormous role in sort of anticipating and even to some degree setting up the kind of discourse of ecology that we're struggling with today. But before we do that, we're going to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Dau, and we're speaking with R.S. Deese about his book We Are Amphibians, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Minds on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dau. We're here with Eric Davis, speaking with R.S. Deese about his work, We Are Amphibians, about the Huxley brothers. So, yeah, I was wondering if we could get into that kind of ecology aspect of the information and that idea of man versus nature, sort of part of it, or that dominating our biology, or somehow like that nature is this imperfect thing that then man or humans have to somehow get involved in it in order for, you know, progress or things to go ahead. So I was wondering, was there any kind of points of focus for all three of them in that respect where it was, I know you said kind of like TH was a little bit like, you know, oh, we just have to be moralistically above our animal nature, whereas, you know, it seems like Julian was more like, oh, we just have to improve biologically, physically upon our animal nature, right, through manipulating it with technology or whatever. And then all of this seemed to, of course, go in the way more kind of Taoist, well, let's just, like, get into what nature is idea. So of those three, was there, like, kind of a general attitude among them where they could come together or maybe, like, fought the most about that idea of what role kind of nature was for humans in terms of our evolution or the progress aspect of that?
Well, that's a great question and a super big one. And I think, you know, one thing that they all had in common was a connection to biology. I mean, the figure that, you know, made the family name T.H. Huxley, you know, that's what he was, really. And I'll say something about each of them in terms of how they thought about both outer and inner nature, if you will. You know, birds and trees and stuff outside of us, and then our own animal selves. And for T.H. Huxley, it was pretty simple. He clearly, you know, had a fascination with nature. He wrote really actually quite poetic descriptions of things that he saw. He traveled around the world as a surgeon on a British vessel, very much, you know, as Darwin had. That is, you know, just studying what he saw. You know, when in framing what it meant and where we should, you know, place ourselves in relation to it. He was pretty solidly Victorian, and that comes across in Evolution and Ethics, even though it's, you know, it's quite a remarkable book. He said, look, we become moral not by imitating cosmic evolution, but by opposing you know, the forces that drove cosmic evolution, which is basically competition for survival. And he uses this analogy of a colony, you know, where he says, look, you could take an island like Tasmania, you know, south of Australia, and it's got a climate, you know, not too different from England because it's far enough south that it's relatively cool. And an English colony could come there and bring English plants and an English way of living, and if they were determined enough, they could make it seem like England. And he frames that as a good thing. He's like, you know, that would be that would be progress, you know, because they would be overcoming the elements that were naturally there and bringing something better, you know. And in that way, he sounds a little bit like a lot of other, you know, enthusiasts for British imperialism, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, and he says, and within, in terms of our nature within, you know, we have all kinds of impulses, et cetera, you know, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde type of stuff. You know, he's writing pretty much from a pre-Freudian point of view, but, you know, there's a lot of stuff you got to keep under control, basically.
Right.
And just as those colonists have to subdue that nature to make it so, make it as nice as England, you know, we have to subdue those things in ourselves that are dangerous, et cetera. So that's his way of thinking. With Julian, you know, his impulse towards conservation of wild places is pretty serious and pretty, you know, pretty heartfelt and pretty early. As a young man, he wanted to preserve a lot of coastline in England that was under threat. And then as a biologist who traveled extensively in Africa, he was very concerned about protecting wildlife. In some ways, that has an imperialistic, you know, element too, and a lot of criticism of 20th century environmentalism, but by environmentalists themselves, you know, has pointed out, you know, the idea of pure nature often cuts indigenous people out of the picture, or their way of life out of the picture. But in terms of wilderness, he was very different from his grandfather. You know, he definitely believed in preserving wilderness for its own sake. When it came to, you know, one's internal nature, he was like a lot of other 20th century people in terms of having, you know, attempting to abandon sexual mores that he viewed as bourgeois. You know, he announced to his wife pretty suddenly that he wanted to have an open marriage when he met a woman who was, you know, 20 years younger than he was, and he wanted to run away with her, you know. But he framed it as like a great, you know, yeah, let's have an open marriage because that's what you should do. So he was very different from his grandfather in terms of having mid-20th century mores rather than late Victorian mores when it came to sexuality. But if you think about all of those other things about human nature that are sort of wild and woolly, like imagination and mysticism, you know, with Julian Huxley, you kind of always feel that the rational self is very firmly in charge, and that he's not so open to, you know, intuition or, you know, types of experience that might not, you know, be amenable or explicable through rational discourse. And so he's really kind of a classic Enlightenment figure, and in that sense, you know, he seemed to have been very comfortable with the idea of, well, you know, let's build a better human. We could do that. You know, we can rationally decide what would be better qualities to have and try to do those things. And he was very, very interested in a rationally planned society, and that came from a kind of Fabian socialist perspective. He was never a Marxist, but he visited the Soviet Union in 1931 and, you know, believed that it was a rationally planned society. because of what he was shown when he visited. And so, you know, that was his way of thinking. And you get to Aldous, great interest in wilderness, although and nature for its own sake, although one of his most brilliant essays from the 1920s is called Wordsworth in the Tropics. And he takes the sort of romantic, you know, love of nature epitomized by someone like Wordsworth and says, you know what, if you took that to the tropics where life is a lot thicker and, you know, and the species you encounter, whether they're large or small, are a lot more likely to kill you, you're not going to have that. You're not going to idealize nature the way that the English romantic poets did. And so Aldous could never avoid being ironic, you know, about anything. So even his love of nature was, you know, tinged with a kind of very mordant irony. And what's interesting about that, though, is that post-World War II, one of the lectures he gave at the University of California, he described himself as an unreconstructed Wordsworthian. As he sort of went back to that Wordsworthian love of nature for its own sake, and yet
I
by
think,
then...
You know, what, one place you can see that with him... later on is with his relationship to the desert, you know, because he goes out to the Antelope Valley during World War II. He lives this very simple kind of proto-hippie life. They're eating beans. He's doing these exercises for his eyes, and he's doing all the reading that goes into the perennial philosophy, which is, of course, you know, also one of his most significant books. And he's in the desert, and he's in a very abstract desert. You know, the Mojave Desert, as you know, is... a very kind of empty place. It, you know, doesn't even have saguaro cactuses. The only thing it has of charismatic note on the level of flora are the Joshua trees. And he, and so Huxley writes about these, and he writes about the sort of there's almost like a transcendental quality to the nature of the desert because it's abstract, because it's sort of ahuman, because it's not. It's neither the riot of the jungle or even the sort of quaint lushness of, you know, Wessex or whatever. It's this kind of like a kind of emptiness. And so there's a weird relationship. And I always felt there was a really interesting relationship between his religious ideas that he develops in the perennial philosophy, this notion of kind of a core experiential power within these different religious traditions that needs to strip away all the rococo elements of religion and superstition and rituals and gods and all that, with the kind of naturalism of the desert, which kind of has a tendency to sort of get down to brass tacks.
I could not have said it better myself. As somebody who grew up in Southern California, I love the fact that Aldous Huxley, you know, became a Wordsworthian again in the deserts of Southern California. You know, it's wonderful. He has a beautiful essay just called The Desert. And he's talking about the deserts of the American Southwest, and it's really quite poetic. And he was also quite aware that, you know, in the Cold War, you know, there were these sort of places where they're building and testing all kinds of horrific weapons. And yet, to his mind, the desert is so big, you know, that it can even put that in a perspective that doesn't lead one to necessarily despair. The other thing about it, you connect that to, exactly right. That's the time that he's working out the vision, that he expresses in the perennial philosophy, is that, you know, we've had a lot of trouble of late with our great monotheistic religions and the fundamentalist strains thereof, you know, the conflicts that grow out of these various, you know, differing visions of a single deity and you know, the I don't know what, you know, call them. They're all rooted in the desert, really. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And it's fascinating that in the, you know, in another desert on the other side of the world, Aldous Huxley articulates this vision of religion that at least presents the, you know, a path towards peaceful coexistence. I suppose someone could write a book on comparative deserts. I don't know, but it's
that would be fun.
It's wonderful that he found his bearings there, and he really loved it. And you know, I guess it's not in my self-interest to promote another book, but Huxley in Hollywood by David King Dunaway does a beautiful job of you know, situating Aldous Huxley in the world of Southern California, which was so much, you know, so much larger than Los Angeles and Hollywood.
I love that book. I also really recommend that to people. And part of the reason I think that Huxley's worth paying more attention to is that if you just know about him sort of casually and you're interested in the human potential movement or the new age or psychedelics or the sort of hippie current and what happened with that, there's much to be learned by understanding where he comes from and particularly the kind of writing he did before he made this sort of California turn, if you will.
Yeah.
Because one of the big questions, and you can see it even in Island, in the beginning of Island, where is that he had such a sarcastic and bitter and while funny and ironic, but a real bitterness in his sarcasm about human beings. You know, a very dark view of most of our motivations and what's really driving us most of the time. I mean, he was capable of being just incredibly withering in that sort of classic British witty style. But because he was also a philosopher, that perception was not just a kind of, you know, ironic dance. It was really a kind of grief almost about human potential and what it actually manifests in most of the cases that we can find in human history and in human culture. So he has this mordant wit. He's going to tear down all of the flimsy, egotistical stories that people use to hide from their own nastiness. And so he has this very dark view. And then you realize that part of his whole way of approaching spirituality, both in terms of the perennial philosophy and the notion of religious experience and practices that are found in various traditions, and in terms of psychedelics, which grow out of that, and the ideas of human potential, of moving beyond that, is that he was almost in kind of it was like a race against time, that human beings as they are, the sort of humanist subject with his desires and, you know, whatever, is corrupt. That's not going to do it. That's going to drive us into hell, into World War III, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And that it's only by cultivating these little buds of possibility that we might, and in this sense, he is a transhumanist, that we might move beyond the sort of human characteristics that he saw as in some ways irreparable. It wasn't like a Christian idea, like, well, we're all flawed, but we're going to make it through, and you know, through the faith in the Lord, we'll kind of keep it together. He was like, no, left to their own devices, with all of these tools and technologies, human beings are going to scuttle the ship. So let's try to build something else out of our potential, and that gives that whole '60s experiment a very different tinge that I think is really important to deal with. It often gets lost later on with the New Age, where they're trying to make everything seem happy and, you know, sex is cool and money is cool and everything's kind of cool. It's all part of like whatever. That there is this sort of misanthropic element to the human potential movement in Huxley that I think is really, really important to see.
There's so much I could say about that, and I might forget all the things I want to say if I start on any one of them, but the first thing I would like to say, you know, is that if your listeners could do anything to make the world a better place, it might be to urge some publisher to print the entire manuscript of Island, because it's a much longer book than was published, and they felt that the editors felt, both his English and his American editor, kind of conspired behind his back to say, look, we're both going to tell him to cut it. You know, we won't, we'll tell him separately, individually to cut it. And, you know, he was interested in getting it published. And he went along with that, and they cut out a lot of philosophical discourse, but also things that, you know, would give the book a little more continuity. And the reason that I think that it's a significant book, still, you know, maybe as a novel, not as best, you know, aesthetically as a novel, but the reason it's a very significant book is that it begins in this kind of Augustinian place of disgust, really, for the human condition, and that is in the person of the protagonist, who's going to, you know, go to Will Farnaby. He's going to go to this island. I won't call it a paradise. I won't even call it a utopia, but a decent society that's not screwing up. You know, that's not fouling its own nest. He's going to go there and he's going to wreck it in the interest of an oil company. And, you know, because it begins in that place, it doesn't have that kind of facile quality that a lot of New Age culture, unfortunately, has had, that doesn't really acknowledge the flaws of humanity or, you know, what, you know, St. Augustine might say, you know, our fallen, you know, corrupted nature, depraved nature, whatever. And yet that's a very strong streak in a lot of Aldous Huxley's writings, and it's certainly a strong streak in Island. The other thing that's amazing about Island, and I don't know if, you know, anyone else has pointed this out, and I don't know if James Cameron ever read it, but it's basically Avatar, or Avatar is basically Island. You've got a place where people are living in a very harmonious and expansive way with their biological community or their ecological community, and your hero is the guy who's there to mess it up, to get at the resources that are underneath it. And that's exactly what, you know, the protagonist of Island is doing. So it really is a remarkable book, and I think that, you know, our civilization could begin to have a informed discussion of it if the whole thing were published. I had to go to UCLA to read the manuscript, and even when I started this, it wasn't even available then. I'll add
just from my own knowledge that Aldous Huxley was also, it was influenced, it's like Avatar, and it's a big story that comes up a lot. And in my experience, I spoke at the Theosophical Lodge where Aldous Huxley used to speak, and I found out that idea that the Theosophists had of a Cratona, right, or this utopia, which also came from Pythagoras, right, and like it yes. had this traceable lineage. So I felt like Island was influenced by a lot of those types of things too, which many, many stories, of course, have taken on that sort of idea.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And he makes reference to Theosophy in Island, and it's fairly critical that it's the mother of the young prince, Murugan, she sort of dominated him, that she had these visions inspired by a Theosophist that he'd met in, that she'd met in Switzerland. And I never, in my own research, I was never able to get to the bottom of Aldous Huxley's motivations there in, you know, sort of casting, you know, Theosophist is sort of the black hats in the story,
I would suspect that it's. I mean, he was a good friend of Krishnamurti, so I think that he saw that Krishnamurti.
Right, he saw what they did to Krishnamurti as a young man. No,
you're
absolutely
like
right.
Making that move away from Theosophy and sort of into a more modern space.
Yeah, I think that's probably sufficient.
Well, you know, Sam, we could keep talking clearly all afternoon, but we got to wrap it up here. So I just wanted to say again that your book, We Are Amphibians, by R.S.D., Julian and Aldous Huxley, on the future of our species is really great. It's short. It's fun to read. There's tons of information, and it really works immediately on reshaping your own ideas about future
human transhumanism, ecology at this point. So it's a wonderful book. It's a very good example of that glinting window of the past that suddenly becomes very prescient and contemporary. So thanks for the book, and thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
It's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you very much.
All right, great. Okay, folks, from Majin Meet, all you out there, keep your minds open.